Dear students of my course, welcome at the second lecture of the Network Science course. Please, to start, please open PhD SEM 2 PowerPoint file and click to slide 1. You should see a title slide which is Networks and Stability Part 2 Refined Network Topology. This will be our subject for the second lecture in this case. If you proceed to the second slides, then you see difficult questions of network studies. And I'm just listing a few of these difficult questions, which are the following: which are the important segments of networks, which are the most important parts of networks, how can I define groups within networks, we call them modules in network science, how can I judge if two networks are similar, how can I compare two evolving networks, how can I measure complexity. This question is actually a very much a long-standing open question of science. And if someone can give a good enough answer to this question, then he or she will certainly receive a Nobel Prize. And the last one, how can I influence the attractor occupancy of dynamic networks in their state space? Now, this last question could be very remote and complex and complicated for you at this moment. But at the end, when we will proceed with this network science course, you will understand all these questions actually. Almost all, and I will give you quite a few solutions for all these difficult problems of network science. So why don't we begin? And we start with important network segments. This is the next slide. And as you can see, it can be defined as locally important or as globally important for the whole system, for the whole complex system described by the network. And as you proceed from locally important segments of the network to globally important segments, then you proceed from hubs, and you may remember from the first lecture, if you listen to the first lecture, please do, if not, then hubs are nodes which have a much higher number of neighbors than the average nodes. So hubs are locally important segments of networks because compared to their neighbors or from the point of their neighbors, they are important because they will give the neighbors a vast amount of information, because they are actually collecting a vast amount of information from their many neighbors in the locality of the network. If we are going towards the global structure of the network one step farther, then we can define central elements, central nodes of the network, and these central nodes are occupying a central position in the network. If you visualize the network, then most of the time these are actually in the center, kind of geometrically also in the center of the network. We can define a network skeleton. Network skeleton is a continuous line or continuous series of edges, network edges. So it is a set of nodes actually which are connected with network edges, and they form a single giant component. But this is not by far of all the nodes and all the edges in the network, but the most important ones, those edges where the highest traffic is going on, where the highest information exchange is going on in the network. So this is the network skeleton. We will talk about all these in much details later, and we can also talk about modular structure, group structure of the network if we are going towards the globally important network elements. And finally, we can talk about a core periphery structure, where the core is the central nodes, are the central nodes of the network, and the periphery is, as what you would expect, the peripheral nodes of the network. And we will detail all this later. So why don't we begin with hubs? The next slide shows you date hubs and party hubs. These are two types of hubs actually. Date hubs are the hubs which are exchanging time to time their neighbors. So it is like a date. This is how it is. It has been given its name, because if you are organizing a date with several partners of yours at the same time, that I wouldn't call a date, that I might call a scandal or a large quarrel. So if you would like to get many partners are kind of simultaneously, which I don't want to kind of classify morally, but one might wish to do that, then the only way to organize these dates is a sequential organization. So this is what date hubs are actually doing. They have different sets of neighbors. Well, in case of hubs, obviously, there are many neighbors at the same time, but the sets of neighbors, the group of neighbors, are changing time to time. One reason of this might be actually that this hub is translocating from one compartment, intracellular compartment, to the other, and in the cytoplasm it has a certain number of neighbors, and then when it translocates to the nucleus, it has a different number or different set of neighbors, and this is how it is actually forming a date hub. Now, party hubs are completely different. Party hubs have a fairly and pretty much stable neighborhood. So they are also hubs. They have many neighbors as date hubs, but at one given time they have these many neighbors, and these are these many neighbors for a long time, kind of continuously, like in a party. Once you are entering to a party and the invited people have been all arrived to this party, then for quite a while, until the first people are starting to leave, you are pretty much a constant group at that party. If you are knowing, or if you will know by the end of the party, most of the people, then you are forming a group. Then most of you, quite many of you, are becoming hubs in this party organization, and that means that you will have practically all the people as neighbors at the party. Now, in party hubs, a complete graph is not necessary, so not everyone is knowing everyone. We are just talking about one node here, the party hub, but certainly this party hub is knowing all the other nodes around him or her, so around that protein, for example, and this is why we call it a party hub. So if we are having a look to the yeast protein interaction network, which is on the right side of the figure, then on the top you see the whole protein-protein interaction network at a very simple representation. This was our knowledge approximately 15 years ago. And if you are deleting date hubs from this structure, then you see that this network, the protein-protein interaction network of the yeast, have been dissociated, have been collapsed, have been cut into several small parts. So date hubs were very much essential to form the giant component, the strongly connected giant component of this yeast protein-protein interaction network. If you remove party hubs, then some fragmentation occurs as well, as you see. But there is a pretty large giant component which is still remaining in the network, and this gives you the idea that actually date hubs are the central connectors of most networks, because they are connecting distant groups of the networks. Just think about it. If something is a date hub, as I mentioned you before as a definition, then it is having different sets of neighbors at a given time. If it is connecting distant groups of the network, then it is quite often happening that at one given time it is attached to one of these distant groups, and slightly later, for example, after a translocation event, or there are many other ways to do that, phosphorylation, for example, or any other change in the activation of the cell, it is binding to another group of the network which was formerly distant, distance-wise, in the protein-protein interaction network, for example, of the yeast. In this way, date hubs are connecting distant segments of the networks. Party hubs are only connecting their own group. If you are deleting the party hub from the middle of the group, there might be another party hub in the same group. So that second party hub, which you haven't deleted, is still connecting that group. This is why most of the groups or most of the network nodes remain connected even after the deletion of a party hub. This gives you an idea between the densely connected regions, so where party hubs are, and the sparsely connected regions. There is a great difference between them. The sparsely connected regions, which are the overlaps between the modules, are containing date hops, and the densely connected regions, which are the middle of the modules, are containing party hops. So this is one major difference between the two. So now in the next slide, I am listing you some types of network centralities. Well, this is a vastly large area of network science. We have approximately, well, at least 300 different definitions for 300 different types of network centrality. So if someone wants to go into details, I just would like to ask you to go into some particular references in the literature. The basic reference, the pharmacology and therapeutics article in what I'm giving to you as one of the core literatures of this course, is listing you quite many of these network centralities and giving you further readings for that. I'm just listing only a few because we don't have time to cover all, obviously, in this small course. So hubs are actually having a centrality which is a local centrality in the network. They have a large degree, they have a large number of neighbors, as I mentioned to you before. Closeness is a sum of shortest paths to other nodes in the network, so it is giving you a more global type of network centrality. Community centrality is a kind of influence of all other nodes to that particular node in any kind of direction of the network, giving into account or taking into account any pathways in that particular network. So that is a kind of summary of effects of all the other nodes in the network to one given node. That is giving you an even more global representation. And the betweenness centrality, which is a widely used centrality measure in network science, is giving you the number of shortest paths which are going through that particular node, one given node of the network. And that is a quite global representation of network centrality, because if there is a node which is having a large number of shortest paths going through it, then it is indeed a globally central element node of the network. Now, I was listing some more centrality definitions in the box, like the H index, for example, or the very famous PageRank. This was the major element of the first Google search machine, and that's why Google was becoming such a worldwide accepted company and such a successful company. Now Google is using quite sophisticated algorithms for search, including some advertisements and some commercial uses, but PageRank was its first baby, its first solution for this problem, and it's a very successful solution. We have subgraph centrality, information centrality, and many more network centralities. Now, at the next slide, we are reaching the network skeleton, which I told you before is an important step towards the global structure of the network. And I will give you a few representations of network skeleton, actually four of them. The very first is can be applied, and it was applied very much first in the literature, in the scientific literature, more than 15 years ago, actually. This can be applied to directed networks. As you can see, this small network on the left side of the figure is a directed network. It has directed edges, so there is a point, there is an arrow representing an edge, which has a start and an end. And you can actually simplify the top network to the bottom one when you are deleting some of these connections, and you are deleting the connections that all the nodes which were reached from the bottom node could be still reached from the bottom node, but there is only one unique pathway going to them. So this is the kind of rule or idea behind the simplification of the network. And this is a very good renormalization. This is how people are calling it, simplification of, for example, a food chain or any type of network which is involving an energy flow. When something like an energy or material is flowing through the network, when something is flowing through the network, it is usually a directed network because the flow has a direction. And this is how these flow type networks can be simplified. And actually, this is giving you a hierarchy of the network. And this hierarchy can be observed in different types of networks, as, for example, in signaling networks, the transcription factors are organized in a hierarchical manner. And there are master transcription factors, and there are smaller transcription factors, and the master transcription factors are regulating the transcription of the smaller transcription factors. And we have actually 4 or 5 layers of transcription factors, one after the other, in a hierarchical manner, and this hierarchical organization can be revealed by such a simplification of the network, of the signaling network, or transcription factor part of the signaling network. Now, the second type of renormalization is was first done by the World Wide Web, and the rule, the general rule, is quite simple. If you find a complete graph, so a set of nodes where all the nodes are connected with all the nodes. So if you have 3 nodes, then all the 3 nodes have to be connected with each other. If you have 2 nodes, then a simple edge is pretty much enough to connect the 2 nodes, obviously. If you have 4 nodes, then all the 4 nodes have to be connected with each other. So the complete graph is when all the nodes are connected with all the nodes in that particular graph. So you are actually looking for complete graphs in this network structure. And if you find one, regardless of its size, whether it had 1, 2 nodes, 3 nodes, or even more, then you are reducing this complete graph to a single node. And you are connecting this single node, as which was the complete graph before, with all the neighbors of the complete graph. And then you have a smaller representation of the network. When you are ready with this, this is the first step, then you are finding complete graphs in the network, which was the result of your first reduction step. And you are repeating this same step. You are connecting these complete graphs and you are condensing them to a single node. And then you are connecting these remaining single nodes. And then you repeat this step once again. What is very interesting and actually surprising, then you can't do this reduction step very many times in a network. The maximum is usually 6 times or 5 to 7 times regularly, or usually if the network is not very large. When you are reaching actually the final point, when you have condensed the whole network into one node, obviously this is the end. You cannot proceed any farther. Now, obviously, when you have reduced the network to one node, then you have lost all the information which was encoded by the original network, so it's rather meaningless. But the steps in between, so when you have reduced the network to by one reduction step, or by 2 reduction steps, or even by 3, that is giving you a simplified structure of the network, and that is giving you the most important segments of the network. Now, you may observe one more thing, which is very surprising, that networks are actually self-similar. So there is a kind of self-similarity from this point of view in the networks, because if the original network had a scale-free degree distribution, so it had hubs, then the first reduction of this network will have hubs as well. The second reduction will have hubs as well, and the degree distribution will be pretty much the same. If the first network was a small world network, we learned all this in the previous lecture, then this is the first reduction is also a small world network, the second one is also, and so on, and so on. So networks are pretty much similar to each other if you are reducing them by this kind of rule. And this gave the authors of the original publication in Nature, it was also approximately 15 years ago, to tell that that networks are actually having a self-similar structure, and self-similar structures are fractals. So there is a kind of fractality in networks. Now, obviously, networks are not complete mathematical fractals, because then they should be completely self-similar, and they are not that much self-similar. They are only approximately self-similar. But this is surprising enough that networks have a certain level of self-similarity. Now, the next slide shows you another two methodologies which can be used for simplifying networks. The first one, which is on the left side of the slide, is when you are doing the very much the same what we have done in the previous case, but we are not simplifying only complete graphs to single nodes, but we are simplifying any types of modules, any types of groups, network groups, to single nodes. Complete graphs can be regarded as network modules, but they are the stricter representation, the most denser representation of network modules. So you can actually find more sparsely represented modules, as in this particular network, which is the network of network scientists, actually. So each node is a person who was a network scientist, and each edge is a collaborative connection, a joint paper between two network scientists. And the nodes which are positioned high in this network scientist network, those are in the middle of some modules, collaboration groups of network science. And the highest node is actually Laszlo Barabási, whom we mentioned, that he was the person who was discovering, together with Zeko Albert, who is also a highly positioned node here, the hubs, the scale-free degree distribution. So this is actually giving you a fairly good representation of network science a few years ago. And you may actually reduce here modules to single nodes, and then you may have one level higher hierarchical representation, a simplified representation of this network. And obviously you can do this once more with this second network, and I think you will reduce the number of nodes to two, actually, because there are two major communities in the second representation of the network, and after that you reduce them to one node, and that's the end of the process. The last method, which is on the right side of the figure, is giving you another type of representation or a simplification process when you are using betweenness centrality, what we defined in the previous slide, a few slides before. So betweenness centrality is the giving you the edges which are most frequently populated or most frequently used in the network, because, as you may remember, betweenness centrality is the number of shortest paths which are going through a given node or a given edge. It can be defined to an edge as well. And if there are many shortest pathways going through a node and an edge, then the probability that this node or edge will be used often by information transfer or signal transduction in that particular network, it is high. So if the probability is high, then it's like a highway. So when you are trying to find a network skeleton, you are trying to find the highways of the network. So this use of betweenness centrality measure is a very good use of finding highways in the network. And as you can see, most networks, as this particular one, can be simplified by this measure to a tree-like structure. So it is almost looking like a tree. It has a trunk, it has some branches, it has some small tiny ends. So it is very much like the highway structure in most of the countries. Obviously, a few highways are connecting the distant regions in most of the highway structures, but the skeleton, the really important part of a highway structure, is looking like a tree in most of the countries, if the country is not very, very large, like that, for example, in the United States. Now, the next slide shows you modules, introduction of modules, which are network groups. And modular nets are very frequent in science. In this figure, which is the left side of the slide, I am showing you four modules. You can see two white ones and two kind of bluish ones. This was actually a high school in the United States, approximately 40-50 years ago, when racial segregation was still present in the United States, especially in that southern state when this high school was situated. And therefore, unfortunately, the white nodes are actually representing white students, Caucasian students in this particular school, and the bluish nodes are representing black students in this Afro-American students in this school. And what is interesting, that there were quite some Asian students in the school, and Asian students were either associating with white or black students, and quite some Asian students were forming actually bridges between these groups. The reason why we have four groups and not only two groups, you might ask this, and that would be a very obvious question, is that we had upper high school and lower high school as well, and unfortunately, or quite obviously, upper high school members have been kind of dissociated from lower high school members because they haven't met in many, many school classes, only in some of the major intervals, and some of them were playing together, so this is why a few connections were established. Why, the next slide, why is it good if a network has modules? Because modules, network groups, are stopping noise damages and synchronization of the network, and can give the different groups of the network different functions. Because if the network is too well connected, too highly connected, and it doesn't have groups, distant groups within the network, then unfortunately the traffic is too high. And it's too evenly distributed in the network, in the whole network, and therefore there is no differentiation occurring in function in different segments of the network. So, because just think about yourself, if you are now listening to this lecture, and someone wants to involve you in a cooking event in the kitchen, that is still pretty much okay if you have accustomed to multitasking, but if someone is arriving, a different person, and wanting to have a chat with you about a different subject, and listening the lecture, having a chat with a person, and cooking the things well, is still at the kitchen, that is getting quite cumbersome and undoable. So this is when three modules of yours, the kitchen or cooking module, the listening module, and the conversating module, have been mixed together, and they are not dissociated well enough. So this is how different functions can be differentiated in a cell or in a brain or in any complex system. So what is the actual situation here? How network groups are formed? What is the definition of network groups? Well, the definition of network groups is using the density of connections. So in a group, the density of connections is high. When you are starting to leave the group and entering to the next group of the next network, then the connection density is getting to be lower. And in the boundary between the two groups of the network, the connection density is the lowest as compared to the centers of both groups. So you have to observe actually the density of connections in the network, and for that there are many, many ways of mathematical descriptions, and therefore there are many, many ways to define network groups mathematically, and one of them is good for a certain type of network, another one is good for another type of network, but this is a common assumption that you have to find the density of connections, and when the connection density is high, then you are in the middle of a group, and when the connection density is low, then you are at the boundary of two or more groups in the network. And network groups can evolve independently because of this independent structures and independent functions. They might have separate functions, as I mentioned you before. This may induce diversity. And this allows the sophisticated regulation by fringe areas. Fringe areas are the overlaps between the modules, are the boundaries between the modules. And if you find yourself in a social network a bridge, so being in a fringe area or boundary or overlap between modules, then you might find yourself in a gatekeeper situation. And if you are a gatekeeper, then you are actually defining what type of information is passing from one module, one group of the social network, to the next module of the social network. So you are, for example, connecting your school and your family, for example, and in the school there is happening something. You might get a bad mark, for example. And it's a very kind of primitive solution for this problem that you are not telling this bad mark to your family or to your father or mother when you were very young, for example, because you believe or you hope that there will be no information transfer between the two groups besides yourself, so it will be never revealed that you have this bad mark. Now, obviously, life will overwrite your ideas, and it turns out that there will be different information channel between your parents and between your school, so you realize that this is not a good kind of solution for this particular problem, but still this gave you a very primitive idea for being a gatekeeper, or for thinking that you are being a gatekeeper between two groups and determining the information transfer between the two groups. Now, next slide tells you that modules have a scale-free size and degree distribution. And this is giving you the idea of what I gave you before, that networks are actually having a self-similar structure. If you have a degree distribution, a distribution of number of neighbors in the nodes, and it is scale-free, then the distribution of neighbors of the modules is also scale-free. So this network is self-similar. So this is actually the very same thing what I told you before. Now, the next slide gives you an example about the idea, which is the title, that modules need optimal overlap. And the example is the brain network, the neuronal network, so the network of single neurons in our brain, actually, in human brains. And I'm talking about the default network. The default network in the brain is the network when you are using, when you don't do anything particular, when you are kind of daydreaming, or when you are not really very much focusing your ideas, but you are kind of thinking just generally, thinking as usual, nothing about special at that very moment. Now, if you compare different types of brains, like a brain of a child who is a small child below the age of 7, or much below the age of 7, then you see that this default network is not very well connected, actually. It is connected, but it's not that well connected as in adults. Now, this means that a child cannot have such multiple connections in the usual function of her or his brain, which means that a child cannot have a general idea about the complexity of the situation around her or around him. This is what we observe when we are looking at the behavior or judgments of a child who is very small. This child is usually following someone, following his or her parents, or following his or her teachers or caretakers, because he or she doesn't have an independent judgment. Why? Because the brain hasn't developed to that level to give those many ideas at the same time, because of the connectedness to that child, which would allow the child to select some of these ideas and to make an independent judgment. Now, an adult is having this complexity already, and if there is an unusual task which doesn't really require a large creative thinking, then the overlap between the modules is pretty low, because, as I mentioned to you before, modules are usually coding a certain task. So if you have to do a certain task, not only by your proteins as a signaling network, for example, but by your brain as a task, what you have learned before, the situation is the same. A segment of your brain, a module of your brain, is encoding this task. These neurons which are connected in this module are not necessarily anatomically close to each other, so they can be far away from each other in the brain structure, but they are connected with active connections, and these active connections can be activated very easily. This is why we call them connected in this brain network. There are very well-developed synapses between them. And if an adult is thinking about a usual task, then mobilizing only one of these modules in her or his brain. Now, if an adult is having a novel task, then the adult usually doesn't know yet the solution for this novel task. So many modules have to be mobilized at the same time, and they have to interact with each other. Therefore, the overlap of these modules is increasing. And this is what is increasing, actually, the creativity of the ideas coming into that brain, into that adult brain. And now you see why the child was unable to do this, because the child was unable to connect distant modules of his or her brain because of the brain structure. It wasn't developed to this level yet as the adult brain. So the creativity of adult thinking is much because of this, connecting distant regions of the brain structure. Now, in some diseases like depression or schizophrenia, the brain structure is too well connected. It's connected too much. It's quite interesting and surprising first that why such different diseases or states like depression and schizophrenia are having this kind of same or similar structure in the brain. Obviously, it's not the same. It's only similar from this point of view. The reason is that if you are a schizophrenic person, then you have an overacting creativity. You are imagining things which are not real. You are imagining a person who is entering to the room, but there is no person actually in the room besides yourself. You are imagining a voice which is talking to you, but there is no voice anywhere in your neighborhood. So this is when the brain is getting to be overactive. And one of the reasons, structural reasons of this, is that modules are getting overly connected. Their overlap is getting much higher than the average, much higher than the optimal. And that is not only suboptimal, but that is actually already pathologic. Now, in depression, I don't know if you have been depressed recently. I don't hope or I don't wish this to you. But actually, we are, when I am recording this message, we are still in the coronavirus virus infection state, and the vaccination procedure have just already started. So there are kind of reasons to be depressed, unfortunately, worldwide. So if someone is depressed, then it is not like that person is laying in his or her bed and doesn't think about anything. Quite many times that person is thinking about quite many things. He's thinking that it would be so nice to start to cook my meal. And it also would be so nice to go down and have a walk. And it would be also so nice to go into the next room where my sport instrument is and do some exercises. But I don't have the strength to do any of this. And this is, again, a different type of overpopulated modules, highly overlapping modules, when the overlap is getting very high between the modules. Because there is a module for the exercise, there is a module for the cooking, and there is a module for the walking. But these modules are interacting with each other, and they are interacting too highly, and therefore the person actually is activating all these modules and cannot decide what to do, because each of them is equally important for him or her at that time, or none of them is important enough. This is the same situation, actually. So when the overlap is high, That is pretty much the same situation when there is no overlap. A potential of very high activity is at all the directions is pretty much the same that the potential for no activity, because you can't decide what to do, and that is typically very much typical to depression. Now the last example in this series is epilepsy. That's a very unfortunate situation, obviously, the epileptic seizure, when you have a complete overlap between the activated neurons of your brain at a large area of the brain, sometimes almost or the full brain. That is not happening, because that's not then obviously lethal, but even a smaller segment of the brain, if it's completely activated, is very much damaging to the brain. So this is a very serious situation which has to be avoided. Now the next slide is showing you a different representation of modular overlaps, which is a kind of hierarchical overlap. And on the left side of the figure, you are seeing a kind of firm structure, a structure of a firm, when the CEO is having a strong position. Why it is called a strong position? Because on the top there is the governing board of the firm, and in the bottom there are the employees of the firm, and this is a hierarchical structure. And only the CEO is connecting the governing board between the employees. So the CEO is a gatekeeper, as I mentioned to you before. The CEO is the only source of information to the governing board from the firm or about the firm. On the other hand, the other representation on the right side of the figure, there are other connections besides the CEO between the governing board and the employees. So if the CEO tells something to the governing board, then it can be overridden by another information coming from one of the employees to the same governing board, and that might be called or was called as a weak CEO, because here the CEO cannot determine the decisions of the governing board that much. Now, when I was showing this to CEOs of Hungarian firms, then actually they were telling to me that, okay, the CEO might be strong in the first case, but the firm itself is weak, because the firm is prone to mistakes of the CEO. So there is no connection in this firm, in the firm of the left side, which can actually repair the bad decisions of the CEO. In the right side, there are some other connections where the governing board has some additional information how the governing board may help actually the CEO and the firm to override the decisions of the CEO if the decision of the CEO was bad. So the firm is actually stronger. Now, next slide is showing you some intermodular bridges, which are key nodes of regulation, and this can be an intermodular hub or an intermodular bridge, or even a bottleneck when this intermodular bridge is the only bridge which is connecting the two modules. And as you can see, the bottleneck is a typical gatekeeper, strong CEO from the previous position, or previous example, but the intermodular hub or the bridge are pretty well centered segments of the network as well. Now the next slide shows you some creative nodes, and this can be possible targets of anti-aging therapies as well. There are three different functions, if you simplify the network functions to general classes. The first function is the gray nodes. This is the vast majority of the nodes. These are problem solvers. These are specialized nodes to a certain problem, which can be a task in the network, and their behavior is predictable. The second function is that of a hub, a central node in the network. It is specialized to signal to task distribution, but it is also predictable. That is, it is its function, the task distribution. There is a task in the network which is a duty which has to be solved by this community, and it is observed by one of the problem solvers or one of the nodes of the network, maybe one of the hubs. And it is either observed by a hub, so it can distribute it to certain nodes, or it is channeled to a hub by a node which was a neighbor of a hub, and then it is distributed by the hub. So this is fairly good. But if the network is having a novel task, which hasn't been distributed ever in the network, then the nodes may send this task to the hub, because they are hoping that the hub has the solution where to distribute this task, because the node cannot solve the task, so it's sending to the boss. But the boss has no idea who can solve this task, because this task has never been solved before by this firm. It is a novel task. Now, this is when this simple structure, what we have seen so far, is going to its end, is non-functional. It cannot solve the task. So what you actually need is the third type of node, which are the creative nodes in the middle of this network, represented by these kind of stars or little suns, shining nodes. And these creative nodes are actually blinking if you are proceeding once more with your forward button. And this blinking, this small animation, wanted to tell you that these are actually dynamically changing their position in the network. These have a few links, a few edges to hubs, and these are giving you, or giving the network, unexpected rerouting of the information. So these are flexible, and their behavior is unpredictable. And why is such a behavior creative? Because it can connect distant regions of the network. And if it's connecting distant regions of the network, then it is producing different novel solutions of the network. The next slide gives you an example of this, coming from Mark Granovetter, who is one of the most famous social scientists of the world, living in the United States, who was discovering quite a long time ago, almost 50 years ago, that useful information comes from a long distance. And he was asking the question how to get an idea about a good job. And obviously at the time, at 1973, there were no job portals, because we have no internet. There were no other measures how to distribute a job. Obviously one may make an advertisement, but it was becoming quite clear that quite many of the jobs at the time haven't been advertised. So these jobs were filled by personal acquaintances, by kind of rumors, asking people around if they find the proper person for that particular job. And in this way, it was an important question to ask: who is giving you a better idea for finding a good job for you? It is your well-known friend or family member, or it is a complete foreigner, or almost a complete foreigner, a distant relative, or a distant friend of yours, or a distant acquaintance of yours. And it turned out that useful information comes from a long distance. So not your family members who are giving you good ideas about novel solutions, but complete foreigners, or almost complete foreigners, whom you pump into the on the street or in an unexpected situation. Those are the people who can give you great ideas about novel problems and solutions for novel problems. So it is a surprise. Why is it a surprise? Because your family members do care about you. Your family members do know you. They know what you wish. So they are in a position to give you a good idea. Still, they cannot give you a good idea. Why? Because their ideas are overlapping with yours. The idea, what you are coming from your family member, you have already known. So it is a redundant idea. You already entertained this idea a long time before, and you either tried it or you discarded it. So it is not a novel solution for your novel problem. So the novel solution must come from a distant region of a social network, which is not your family, certainly. So girls or women are in a much better position because they are talkative. They are more communicable than men as an average person, especially in Hungary. In the United States, it might be more equal, or in other countries. So women are talking to complete foreigners, like when they are shopping, for example, or when when they are going to the lavatory or when they are doing different things. Men are not doing idle conversations during these things because they are focusing on the task. If they are shopping, they are shopping. If they are going to the lavatory, they are going to the lavatory. They are not asking completely unrelated questions to people whom they find in the lavatory or whom they find in the shopping mall. But then they lose. These men are losing completely novel ideas, which they might come or might get if they would have asked unrelated questions in these times. Now, the next slide is showing you a social network. The title is Structural Holes, so this should be your slide now. And in the social network, nodes are persons, edges are connections, social connections. And there are two persons highlighted, Robert and James. And Robert is a broker in this network. Robert is a key person in this network. And James is a loser. Why James is a loser? Because James has neighbors which are connected to each other. So if James tells something to one of his neighbors, there is a high chance that that neighbor has already known this from another source. So James is a boring person. Robert is a very interesting person because Robert is the only source of information between groups A and groups C, D. So anything which is an information coming from group A is coming through Robert. And Robert is always a source of novel information in this small social network. So James should change his network position if James is a wise person, and should leave some of his friends and should connect with some of the people in group A or group C and D. And in this way, in this small social network, James might be a competitor of Robert as a broker of the network. But many Jameses, many people in the position of James, do not realize their own position, or they are much frightened to make acquaintances in distant groups because that might ridicule them or might understood things differently and so on, might laugh at them. And therefore, Roberts are pretty unique in networks and they are pretty much powerful. So the art of networking in the next slide is showing you these two complementary networking strategies: the safety seeking, which was the strategy of James, and the novelty seeking, which was the strategy of Robert. And you have to do actually both if you would like to be a good networker in a social network. Now the next part of our lecture, which is getting to the end, is the core periphery structure of the network. And as you can see, the core is in the middle, the periphery is on the side. If you have a directed network, then you have an incoming periphery and an outgoing periphery because of the directions of the edges. And what is the important take-home message? That the size of the core can be regulated. The size of the core can be small, and that is a very tightly regulated network. And the size of the core can be actually large, which is a very loosely regulated. So when the network wants to have a tight regulation, then it is reducing its core. When it wants to have a loose regulation, then it's expanding its core. Now, you may understand this point from the previous example. If you have a usual task, then you have to reduce your network core, because then a hierarchical organization of the network is important, because the hierarchical organization will solve this task very efficiently. Now, if you have a novel task, then you have then you need creativity of the network. Then you have to expand the core of the network. Now, this is why dictatorships are not very useful for solving novel problems of the society, because dictatorships have a small core, obviously, because the final core in a dictatorship is the dictator. So dictatorships must have an end, actually. And in the ancient Rome, when in the ancient Rome was invaded by foreign troops, then the ancient Romans were actually electing a dictator, because they had to organize a very efficient defense against this situation. But when the enemy was defeated or was left, then the dictator was giving back the power to the Senate of the ancient Rome. So this was a very well-designed structure for different types of situations, and we have to learn from this. Major types of core periphery networks are the rich glove networks, where hubs are preferentially connected with each other and forming the core. The nesting network is a network which we seldom use. It is used in ecosystems, but the onion network has several layers of connections. As you can see, the outer layer is highlighted by the red edges. And this network is very much resistant against the removal of any random nodes, and at the same time against the removal of hubs, so central nodes of the network. Not surprisingly, crime networks, so smuggling networks, drug trafficking networks, and other crime networks, black networks, dark networks, are having this structure, or this onion structure, which have been discovered actually mathematically, looking for these very resilient types of networks. So actually, this was the end of this segment or lecture of the network science course. See you at the third lecture, which is given at a different slide at a different time. Thank you very much for your listening.